film now this evening. Three movies up for review. Simian sequel, Dawn of Planet of the Apes. Mike Myers' directorial debut in a film called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. It's a documentary. And Grand Central, a love story set in and around a nuclear power plant. Sinead Gleeson and Paul Whittington have been to see them for us. They're with me in studio this evening. We'll start with Dawn of Planet of the Apes. This is the sequel to the 2011 reboot of the whole Planet of the Apes series. That was called Rise of Planet of the Apes. So where did that story leave off, Sinead, and where does this second part pick up?
Well, we're 10 years on from the previous film, and the simian flu that was obviously appeared in that film has wiped out most of the humans, but a colony of apes are living in the hills above San Francisco. They're sort of subsisting in peace and harmony and minding their own business until one day a small group of humans who have survived, and they literally haven't seen humans in a couple of years, sort of arrive out of the mists of the forest and sort of say, hey, we know that you've got an old dam here, an old hydro dam, and if the human race is to try and rebuild itself and survive, we want to try and get it working again. So how do you feel about that? And that sort of sets up the whole story.
I suppose the look of this is one of the most important things from the outset, Paul. And this was done before. It's a motion capture type of effect.
Yeah, mainly, and other effects as well, yeah.
How believable is the look, first of all?
Well, Sean, it's so believable that you actually forget about the effects after 10 minutes. And if I had a criticism of the film, it's a slight one. It's that the humans in the film really are secondary to the apes. That's how interesting the apes are, exactly. I think it's a backhanded compliment. You actually see Andy Serkis perform. I mean, because they're rapidly advancing. And it's all our fault. In the first reboot, we started injecting them with potential Alzheimer's cures, and they became hyper-intelligent. One in particular, Caesar, he's the leader.
That's the character played by Andy Serkis.
Yes, and they're rapidly evolving because of this, and he's teaching them all sorts of things, and there's even the beginnings of speech. That's all done really subtly and nicely and well, and it's all been thought about. And, the performance capture works tremendously well.
Now, Paul has mentioned there that the ape characters are in some ways more developed than the human characters, but Malcolm, played by Jason Clarke, and his wife, Ellie, is it, played by Kerry Russell, they're sort of at the heart of the human side of the story.
Yeah, they're not married, they're partners, and it transpires that she has lost a child in the past and that he is a teenage son who's with them.
Right.
So they're trying to be a sort of nuclear family, and they're very sort of bonded.
And there is a nuclear family too within the ape colony.
Yeah, there is, and that's done very well actually, because again, it's trying to sort of contrast the two worlds and saying, look, both of these different species want to survive and be in the same world, but the humans are not weirdly the humans are not faring as well because they don't have some of the skills of survival, if you like.
And Caesar's partner, or is he married? I'm not sure whether an ape can be married or not.
It's an unofficial.
It's an unofficial. It's a life partner, we'll say.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Cornelia is her name, and she's played by Judy Greer. Now here are the ape couple and the human couple interacting with each other.
I'm sorry. That was all my fault, but I will make him leave.
This my home. You should not be here.
I understand.
Malcolm.
She's sick.
How long has she been this way? I have medicine. Antibiotics.
Maybe she can help.
Do not trust you.
I don't blame you. But believe me, we are not all like him.
Please, let us help you.
One day, you stay. One day.
We might need a little more time.
One day!
Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell as the two humans, Andy Serkis and Judy Greer as the two apes in that sequence from Dawn of Planet of the Apes, although the Judy Greer character clearly ill and not saying too much in that particular clip. There's a very dark and ominous tone to that section of the movie. Matt Reeves is the director here. Does he lift it out of that darkness? I mean, I remember from the television series in the earlier types of Planet of the Apes films. There was sort of a charm about them.
I thought that from right out of the traps from the beginning of the film, this is there's a real sense of menace, of terror, of something awful going to happen all the way through. And I think there's a guy called Michael Giacchino who weirdly did the music for Up and things like The Incredibles, but also did things like Medal of Honor and sort of video games. And there's this sort of almost drone-like, terrifying music that's going on in the background the whole time that's indicating what's going to happen, that something awful, there is going to be conflict down the road.
Is this predictable?
This is the thing about the film. I mean, there's lots of things that I liked about it, but I thought that in terms of the story arc, and you heard a bit of it there, and that sort of interaction, that it's the two communities are, you know, separately living apart, and there's calmness, then there's a sense of conflict, then there's a breach of trust, and then all hell breaks loose. And that's a really familiar sort of story arc. We've heard it and seen it before. And it seems like that. The bad guys, in this case, the humans, are able to, you know, sail in with the medicine to help the sort of ailing ape.
Is there enough in this reboot and in this second part of the reboot? I know critics and audiences loved the first part of this sequence. Is there enough in it to merit remaking Planet of the Apes again?
Oh, I absolutely think so. I think they're much better than the original films. I know some people won't agree with that, but the first one, which was great, the 68 one, it did have Charlton Heston in it, so there was no sense of humour or whatever. These ones, they're much more accomplished. I know they're not original in that sense, but this one, I think I like this one slightly more than Sinead. And in the story, the actual, you could pare down the story and say maybe there's not that much to it, but there's all this sort of biblical stuff in it. There's echoes of the way of America's relationship with Native Americans.
So
there's Shakespeare.
Is there allegory going on
there
for today?
There is, and he has a rival, his second in command, who's called Koba, which was one of Stalin's nicknames. So, I mean, it's all going on there. Khmer Rouge stuff, everything. I thought it was great. It's very dark, but it's done very well. In the
stars from you, Paul?
Definitely four for me, at least.
I don't think you're as keen, Sinead.
Oh, no, I mean, I was. I had some problems with the story, but then it's so visually arresting to look at, and it has a lot more brain than a lot of the films that are made in this sort of canon. So I did really enjoy it. I felt it dipped a little in places, but I thought it was very enjoyable, and it looks astounding. So I'd give it 3.
All right, OK. Let's move on then to our second film this evening, a documentary, Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. Shep Gordon is a real man. Who is he, Paul?
He is a real man. This is directed by Mike Myers, who rather immodestly says, a film by Mike Myers at the start, and then reminds us at the end of the opening sequence that he also directed it. But in fairness to him, he can't get a gig at the moment, so I feel a bit sorry for him. Yes, this extraordinary story would have to be made up if it wasn't real. But this guy, he came to... he's a great storyteller. He came to... Some of them should be taken with a pinch of salt, maybe. He came to, he was a Jewish boy from Long Island. He came to Los Angeles in the 1960s. And if we are to believe him, met up with, and his neighbour was Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. And Jimi Hendrix
said, at the Landmark Hotel, where a lot of things went on.
Yeah, went on there. And Jimi Hendrix said to him, "You're Jewish, aren't you? Why aren't you an agent?" Which was very good advice. So he decided to go away from this.
Also totally racist, I would have thought, isn't it?
I'd say that would have been...
Michael Douglas calls him a Jew-boo at some point, which means he's a Jewish Buddhist.
Yeah. But anyway, good advice, however, well-intentioned, I'd say. So he stopped the drug dealing, took up the band management, and he managed Alice Cooper. And Alice Cooper was going nowhere fast, and he really ingeniously, through stunts, the headless chicken, all this kind of stuff, he managed to make him into a superstar.
Well, the headless chicken stunt was where they put a live chicken on stage and the audience basically tore it apart and threw it back up, which might offend some people. But here's a clip which is a little less contentious, perhaps. It's all about see-through clothing. Alice Cooper and Shep Gordon himself are telling the tale.
A lot of people were starting to get busted for drugs at the Landmark. It just seemed like I better stop. So I sat down with Alice and I said, "If you want to really do this seriously, let's do it." We made a pact that we were going to stay together till we were millionaires.
There was never, ever a thought of maybe Shep's not the right guy. No matter what this was, he would navigate us through this rough passage right here.
We started to get other gigs, but it wasn't enough to live on. And I realized that I had to do something radical. The acts that occupied the ground that we wanted to get to, part of their appeal was hatred by parents.
We knew that if you could get the parents to hate you, the kids were going to love you.
I came up with this ridiculous idea of buying see-through clothes made out of clear plastic, putting Alice on stage naked, basically, and calling the police and getting them arrested for indecent exposure, which we assumed would get newspaper coverage and would get parents to say, "Ooh, these guys are disgusting. They played naked." They get up on stage completely naked. People in the audience are like, "Oh my God, So I went to a phone booth and called the police, told them that I had my child at a club and this band was naked on stage and this was horrible. How could they allow this to happen? Put the phone down, I hear a siren, and as the police come around, their see-through clothes had fogged up from the heat and you couldn't see anything. And the police came in and looked around like, what, are they crazy, and left. After the show, I said, you know, we've just hit that classic moment where we can't get arrested. It's definitely time to leave the city.
That's Shep Gordon telling a story about Shep Gordon. Now, he knows how to spin a tale. How many pinches of salt do you have when you're listening to these stories?
Oh, probably a whole vat of it. But I didn't care because they were so entertaining. And it's also, if you listen to the way he tells the stories, it's a masterclass in PR and how to get your artists known. I mean, he literally had no experience. He didn't know what he was doing. And there's all these sort of stories about the Alice Cooper ones. When he went to London, I mean, he'd booked Wembley Arena and they'd sold 50 tickets. So he hired this big truck with a picture of Alice Cooper on the side and got it to break down in Piccadilly Circus. And he said to the truck driver, don't move on. Like, pretend it's broken down and don't move on if the police try to move you on. And the guy's like, I'm going to get arrested. He goes, we'll sort you out money-wise. Don't worry, but don't move that truck. And of course, everybody bought tickets and the gig sold out.
Who else? So Alice Cooper was one of the big clients. Who else are the big clients that we get to hear? Mike Myers, incidentally, was one of his clients as well, wasn't he?
Yes, he is. And actually, Michael Douglas is probably the best thing in it. He's really funny telling these stories about him. And he's a friend of his because he later in his life, he moved to Maui and he'd have these great dinners and he'd bring everybody together. And the Dalai Lama has stayed in his house, of course.
And he's also somebody which I didn't know about. He sort of invented the idea of the celebrity chef. He sort of got these really high profile chefs on. He says a lot of things that he did. But again, all these sort of guys getting cookery shows and tours and books. And basically, he made a lot of people. And that's, I think, one of the things about the film where he says at the end, and it's quite a sad moment, that, you know, I retire, I don't really know what to do with my life. It wanted to be my life because I put my life into other people's for the last 30, 40 years.
But do we get any? I mean, it sounds as if Mike Myers clearly loves the man and everything is great and there are no questions asked about anything.
No, there aren't. And I noticed that Blondie, who were one of his big acts, do not make an appearance in the thing.
Oh, so nor does Sharon Stone, who Sharon used to go out with.
Yeah, he went out with Sharon Stone. He was quite the ladies' man, and Michael Douglas talks about that. And he went out with Sharon Stone for a couple of years, actually. No, there are no dissenting voices whatsoever.
And is that a flaw?
Yes, it is, but it doesn't. And the film is a bit of a mess as well, in my opinion, but it doesn't matter
it's
because the stories are so good.
It's sort of like Mike Myers giving him a This Is Your Life moment.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a hagiography. It's like everyone clearly loves this guy and he's been very altruistic, been very kind to people, really helped people out when they were, you know, had drug problems or money problems, and everyone seems to love him. So I think
and
this
he fostered
sort of
a black family as well, we find out. So it really is sugar. He did do that though. Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so maybe there are sides that need to be praised as
Definitely.
So it's a bit of fun. How many stars from you, Sinead, overall?
I think I'd give it a 4, even though there's like loads of cheesy, intrusive music that's meant to tell you how sad you're meant to feel. Certain times, and the production values are a little bit ropey, but it's really entertaining. I really liked it. 4.
And from you, Paul?
3 for me, but I did enjoy it a lot.
All right, let's move on to our final movie then this evening, Grand Central. This has been billed, Sinead, as a love triangle set around a radioactive landscape.
I know, it's got it all, doesn't it?
It sounds like the dodgiest premise in the world. What exactly is happening here? Because there are some serious filmmakers and actors involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is Rebecca Slatowski. This is her second film and there's been a lot of talk about her. She's a young French filmmaker and she managed to get Tahir Rahim, who was in A Prophet, and he was brilliant in that. And then obviously Léa Seydoux, who everyone knows from Blue is the Warmest Colour. So she's got a really sort of interesting, and the guy whose name I can't remember, who's in Inglourious Basterds, Denis Menochet.
Denis Menochet.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's very a small story in a lot of ways. It focuses initially on a young man called Gary who comes from a sort of broken family and sort of goes on this peripatetic, I have to get away from this life and find something new. So he arrives at this sort of camp for workers who are you know, badly treated. It's very haphazard set up, but they clean and work in these nuclear reactors. Everyone sleeps near the area, so everyone's very, you know, it's very communal. Everyone's sort of, you know, in each other's pockets, but it's these sort of pseudo families get formed, and he finds a sense of connection that he didn't have in his old life.
But he's stupid. Well, I don't know whether he's stupid enough, but he falls in love with his best friend's girlfriend.
Who's engaged to somebody else. But their first encounter is very charged. She sort of kisses him in their first encounter as a way of sort of saying hello, and you know what's going to happen,
trouble.
And that you know it's not going to have a
good
ending.
So we have a love story bit, and we have this blue collar nuclear plant bit.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about the nuclear plant bit and the sort of the atmosphere that's created in there.
Well, that's the interesting bit for me. The love story doesn't really work for me, but the nuclear plant I thought was very interesting. Basically, they work quite near the core and there's an acceptable level of radiation every day and that they keep a diary and build it up. But it's obviously dangerous. And the way they party is, as you were saying there, It's like the way soldiers party. You know, they live
they're in
high.
They're living in the face of death
and
the scenes
in the plant are really good, and they reminded me of films like, you know, The Wages of Fear, the Clouseau film. This is a fantastic atmosphere, and I think that's broken somewhat
by
the love story for me. But the parts in and around the power plant and the way the sound is used, Sinead, as well, is really brilliant.
You're nodding in agreement there, Sinead. Is the problem in the love story, because Lea Seydoux was, I certainly thought she was great in Blue as the Warmest Colour, is it her performance or is there a problem in the writing? And presumably the writing is Zlotowski's as well.
Yeah, I thought the problems with some of the writing, because she's a wonderful actress and I thought her character was a little bit one-dimensional. He kind of, every time he's on the screen, you can't take your eyes off him, and his role
That's
is much better written.
Raheem.
Yeah, and I would kind of agree with Paul that in a weird way it feels like two different films. I could have watched this kind of Silkwood-esque type nuclear film and then the love story, which worked fine on its own. It wasn't very original or wasn't very engaging, but they didn't fit together as two parts of film. And then I kind of wondered, why did you go to all that trouble to set it in that place?
Is there any sort of ham-fisted attempt to say that, you know, the power of the love story and the danger of the love story is something like the power and the danger of the...
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. There's a big sort of siren moment later on, and it's really... which is kind of good and bad at the same time.
Yeah,
and
towards the end things get a little bit signposted and you feel a bit let down by it. Mm.
So how does that translate into stars from you, first of all, Paul?
I suppose three and a half for me, because a lot of it's very strong. I just didn't, as Sinead was saying, it's two films. But the bit that's good is very good.
All right, and from you, Sinead?
Yeah, I'd go three. Raheem is just wonderful to watch. Yeah. And again, the landscape, the idea they used to go to this island, and it contrasts that sort of rural idyllic with the sort of crazy, you know, metal and industry of the reactors. It's very well shot.
All right, Paul Whittington and Sinead Gleeson talking to us about Dawn of Planet of the Apes and Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, both of which are on general release, and the final film there, Grand Central, which is on limited release from tomorrow.